We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, we are going to continue your election endorsements that you began last week.
Yeah, we started off last week with the Eat the State editorial endorsements, and we covered the ballot initiatives last week, and those are all of this, in fact, is up at www.eatthestate.org. It's the lead article, and we're going to move on this week and talk primarily about elected offices. And let us start with the federal offices and U.S. Senator, and I've got to give props to Jeff Stevens, who wrote the endorsement article this time, for one of the better lines we've had in a while in our endorsement article, which I can't really repeat on the radio, except that it involves Dino Rossity, a hand, an orifice, and the BIAW. but it's not entirely accurate, because it's not just the BIAW that Dino Rossi is a captive interest of. He's also taken a huge amount of money from Wall Street, which is one of the reasons why he's been so affirmed to the financial reform package. He's pledging for the repeal of Obamacare. He's really been courting the Tea Party platform, but trying to soft pedal that, and has been really assisted in that a great deal by media in Washington State, which has really been going for the warm and fuzzy Dino Rossi, and the fact that Rossi has really flooded the airwaves and flooded the internet with ads from outside sources, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and a number of the other independent groups that have been freed by the Citizens United decision to put a lot of money into this race. That does not change the fact that Rossi would be a disaster as a U.S. senator. He's talking about, climate change not existing, and all the things you're reading about really nutty Tea Party candidates saying. Dino Rossi's been saying and pledging the same things, and as flawed as Patty Murray may be, and I think she's got her pluses and minuses, Dino Rossi doesn't really have any upside, and he has an enormous downside, so we're recommending Patty Murray on that one. I see Maria nodding over there,
yeah.
But this is radio, so if you enunciate, people can see it more clearly. We also have the congressional races, and the only one here that is really notable in terms of being contested, there are two in Washington State. One is the open seat in the 3rd District in Southwest Washington, in which sort of Democratic corporate tool Denny Heck is running against a woman who is, again, sort of a ambitious Tea Party type. And that's not really much of a choice, to be honest with you, but there is a very good choice on the east side in the 8th District, where Susan DelBene is running against Dave Reichert and has been closing in on Reichert in the polls in recent weeks. She's actually very, very good. She's probably a little more moderate than I would prefer on some issues, but she's, I interviewed her along with a colleague last spring, one-on-one at length, and I came away very impressed by her knowledgeability, her willingness to study the issues and actually listen to different constituents, none of which has distinguished Dave Reichert's, 6 years in Congress. So, a strong nod to Susan DelBene. And incidentally, that's almost exactly the same reason that the Seattle Times used in endorsing her, when they've been shameless apologists for Riker throughout his last 6 years, and they've reversed themselves this year. So I think they may have finally actually noticed what the rest of us have been noticing all along, that there's no there with Dave Riker. On district number 7, the Jim McDermott Congressman for Life District, Jeff recommends that we write in Peter Steinbrück, and I don't think that's a bad idea at all.
Since McDermott will probably get elected with a 90% vote,
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, and Steinbrück is obviously one of the people that is probably, has in the back of his mind that McDermott's going to retire someday. And there's a lot of people lined up who would like that seat when McDermott does retire, probably in 2 or 4 years. There are a whole bunch of seats up for grabs in Washington State Legislature. The Seattle delegation to the Washington State Legislature isn't particularly encouraging. There are a few people that are very good from the delegation, in no particular order, from the 11th District, Zach Hudgens and Bob Hasegawa as representatives, State Senator Marilyn Chase in the 32nd in Shoreline in North Seattle, Jeannie Cole Wells in District 36, Adam Klein and Eric Pettigrew, Senator and Representative respectively in Southeast Seattle District 37, and in 46, Phyllis Keeney. But there aren't a whole lot of there's not a whole lot to choose from in terms of the state delegation. There are a few suburban races, incidentally, where there are some really serious whack jobs running in, on the Republican side of the ticket. If you, live in one of those districts, take a very, very close look at the Republican candidates running before you cast one of those ballots, because, some of them are just beyond the pale. Let's see, King County Council, the only real contested race is District Number 8, where a couple of people are vying to replace Dow Constantine's old seat, and we've endorsed Joe McDermott, even though he's he's sort of a Democratic Party hack, and I don't necessarily say that in a negative way. But the problem is that the King County Council at this point, even though we passed a voter initiative a couple of years ago that officially made it nonpartisan, and it's still an extremely partisan body. There really is no such thing as working across the aisle. It's very similar, in fact, in the situation to what we've seen in the U.S. Congress recently, where McDermott's opponent is talking about, well, I'll reach across the aisle and work with Republicans and Democrats alike. And that just tells me that she doesn't understand how the council works. That's kind of a problem. So we're going with Joe McDermott in that one. The Washington State Supreme Court, the only real contested race at this point, is one between Richard Sanders, the conservative libertarian incumbent, and Judge Charlie Wiggins. And Jeff and I had something of a disagreement on this. He's voting for Wiggins, which I think is sort of the standard progressive reaction. I actually kind of like Sanders, but only in the sense that he's a minority on the court. If there were five Richard Sanders on the court, I'd be very worried. But he is libertarian in the sense of being very concerned about overreach in government and state power, and particularly in terms of civil liberties. And even though I certainly don't agree with a lot of his political views, but in terms of his rulings on the court, I think that's a very valuable role to have at least one of those on the state Supreme Court. So I don't know how you feel about that, Maria. But.
Well, you can go either way. Sanders was one of the two judges, along with Jim Johnson this week, who was sort of outed by civil liberties folks when he was caught saying at a forum that blacks commit more crimes in this area than whites do. That just kind of shows you the
he's a throwback.
Yeah, how much of a conservative he is, and
we have another word for that. It's called bigot.
Yeah, and it's also lacking a serious understanding of the class dynamics involved too in racism, and how a person's skin color can determine their economic opportunities and the fact that crime is more common among folks who are living in poverty, and that the reason is not because of their skin color, it's because of the lack of economic opportunities for them. That just kind of shows you the lack of understanding of class dynamic and racism, and that's unfortunate in a man who's a judge. However, he is a Supreme Court judge, and he doesn't hear as many cases where that would be a determining factor. He hears a lot of cases that reach the Supreme Court level and are argued more on state constitutional issues.
Right.
And national constitutional issues. And as Job said, it can be very important at that level to have someone who is a very strong advocate of individual liberties.
And unlike Johnson, for whom there's really no redeeming value at all.
Yeah.
Corporate
shill.
Yeah. Johnson's very much a corporate shill, a former lawyer for Tim Iman, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Sanders is much more independent than that. And so I'm recommending him, but I certainly understand people who vote the other way.
I do too.
At the lower court level, there's really only a couple of contested races. It's Seattle Municipal Court Judge Position Number 1. It's Sonia Charles has a long history of social justice work and work as a very well-respected judge at lower levels. And in Judge Position Number 6, the same is true of Michael Salvador Hurtado. So those are the two picks that we have there.
Yeah, I agree with both of those.
The charter amendments number 1 through 3, for King County, those are all basically housekeeping charter amendments as near as I can tell. So we're recommending yes on those. King County proposition number 1, would increase King County sales taxes by 0.2% to, pay for criminal justice and law programs that otherwise likely would be cut. did we talk about this last week? This sounds familiar.
I think maybe we talked about it over the phone. I don't think we talked about it on the air.
Yeah, you might be right. We actually do talk about these things in our spare time too. Uh-huh. We have this illness, you see. there's pills we can take, but we're not very good at taking them. You can go either way on this one too. Jeff recommends yes. I have big concerns about it because it's another sales tax. And it's a sales tax to pay for essential criminal justice things, yes. But on the other hand, criminal justice is really the only thing left that can be cut out of the county budget. And if it's a choice between that and another regressive sales tax hike, I'm inclined to say let them be cut.
Yeah. And on the other hand, you could vote for it saying that, of course, some of the first things to get cut out of the criminal justice budget are some of the things that are most needed, including
the diversion programs.
Including diversion programs and programs to help youth stay out of criminal activity, et cetera, and those things do need to be funded before we need to hire more sheriff's deputies. But, on the other hand, as Job said, again, it's a sales tax, and sales tax is regressive. There have got to be better ways to fund these things.
Yeah. And that again gets back to 1098, the initiative that we talked about last week, where, one of the problems with all of these budget issues, and we're going to talk about this again in a second with the school district proposition, is the funding mechanisms that are available to these various taxing districts, because under the state constitution, they have to use regressive taxes because those are the only tools available to them.
Yeah.
Until that changes, we're going to be left with very unsatisfactory choices in these kind of situations. So the other proposition that we didn't get to last week is the Seattle School District proposition number one. This is the general operating levy, and this is because the state really isn't following through on its constitutionally mandated requirement that actually, fund K-12 education. So the school district is having to make up the shortfall for its operating levy. And I actually like Jeff's comment here too. Oh, by the way, how's that Pentagon fundraising bake sale coming?
Yeah.
So we're recommending yes on that one. As problematic as some of the school board's decisions have been in recent years, number one, the public schools still need money to operate. And number two, that school board dynamic is not going to be changed by voting no on the operating levy. That just means the levy will be, resubmitted until they get a yes vote on it. What needs to happen to change the school board's behavior is for more people to show up at school board meetings and between meetings and raise holy heck about some of those policies. The operating levy is not a place for a referendum on how the school board operates.
All right. Does that wrap it up?
I agree with that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving on to other things.
Oh, and once again, all that is at www.eatthestate.org, along with all the initiatives and other ballot issues coming from that we covered last week.
And as always, you don't have to take our word for it. We urge you to read the voter's pamphlet, do your own research, and make up your own mind.
Absolutely.
All right.
And the other caveat that we always throw in is that if voting actually changed things, it would be illegal. So, get out there and get active and get involved in the community also, because that's where the real change begins.
Voting is just a first step.
The voting is the last step.
Yes.
because the reason we have bad choices on the ballot is because we don't have the grassroots movement to put good choices in the ballot in the first place. So, the voting is an important part of the process, but you can't do it voting alone.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to our King County road system.
Yeah, King County this week issued a report that said 30-40% of its roads are at risk of failure over the next decade, that their annual budget for maintenance should be about $120 million just to keep everything functioning, but this year and in future years are going to be at least $18 million short. And, of course, they cite three reasons for this. One is the Iman car tab tax repeal. The second reason is the Iman cap on property tax increases. In other words, hamstringing the county in terms of the revenue it can collect for transportation needs. And the third reason is annexation of land by cities, which is eroding the county's tax base. So this comes after the American Society of Civil Engineers gave infrastructure in the entire U.S. a grade of D It just goes to show if you starve government to the point where it can't fund these basic needs, it's going to lose basic services, including some of the roads and bridges that you need to use.
And once again, Tim Iman is back again. And if 1053 passes, getting back to the initiative again, you're going to have much more of these problems in the future.
Yep.
All right.
And by the way, is that a party that I hear Mike Begin throwing?
Moving on.
We can't have roads. Roads are bad.
Yeah.
You have roads, you put cars
incentives,
on them.
Incentives for the tunnel.
Yeah, Washington State, in a sign of the impending cost overruns for the downtown traffic tunnel to replace the viaduct, the state awarded half of the reserve funds that were set aside in case of overruns to one of the two companies, whichever one manages to win the bid. Now, there are two companies that are preparing a bid for construction on the tunnel. The state hasn't chosen one over the other yet, but the two companies told the state, look, we can't bid this project at the budget that you've assigned for it. It's going to cost more than the $1.96 billion that you've told us it's going to cost, and we need at least half of the reserve funds in order to just submit a bid. So I find that very interesting, that when you've already used half of your funds set aside for cost overruns and the bid hasn't even come in yet, that means that's just not a good sign. That means cost overruns are not only likely, they're almost assured.
Yeah, the idea of putting aside some extra money for a rainy day is not a very good idea in a climate where you have, you know, several hundred rainy days a year. You need more than a rainy day. And this once again tells you what happens when you rig the process in the first place in terms of the decision making, where they overestimated the cost of the surface options and they lowballed the cost of the tunnel. And we're going to be paying the price for that for years to come.
Yep.
All right. Moving on, the state making a decision on minimum wage.
Yeah, Labor and Industries made the decision this week. They're the folks who are charged with it, of raising Washington State's minimum wage by 12 cents an hour in 2011. They are the folks that are charged with deciding how, under a voter-approved initiative that ties the state minimum wage to the rate of inflation, how much the inflation is in any given year, and thus how much to raise the minimum wage. Now, they had asked State Attorney General Rob McKenna last month for an opinion on whether the state should be able to raise the minimum wage if the raise wouldn't be above the current rate above the level that the current rate is based upon. And McKenna came back saying, no, you shouldn't raise the minimum wage. And he did it on a very arcane reading of what should be fairly plain language in the statute. So Labor and Industry basically has come back this past week and said, we don't think courts would agree with this. If this were taken to court, if we made the decision not to raise the minimum wage this year, therefore we're going to raise it by the 12 cents an hour. What they're saying basically is they don't trust the state's lead attorney to give them non-political opinions, because of course the idea of not raising a minimum wage very in line with standard Republican ideology. We've seen this more and more for Rob McKenna in the past couple of years. We saw it with the whole Peter Goldmark flap over refusing to represent him in a case involving eminent domain in Okanagan County. We've seen it on a couple of other instances as well, where McKenna more and more has been inserting his own ideological preferences into his job as Attorney General, probably preparing for a gubernatorial run in 2012, because we weren't seeing this in McKenna's first term as Attorney General. And it's very disturbing to see, to be honest, for a couple of reasons. Number one, because he's not doing the state any favors by not doing his job as lead attorney as Attorney General. And second, it tells you who he's going to try and appeal to when he runs for governor in 2012.
All right. Well, from news of the minimum wage to this week's economic news.
Yeah, a couple of issues in terms of the mortgage and foreclosure scandal. There's been some focus this week on the foreclosure mills. Those are law firms hired by banks to process legal paperwork for foreclosures. Some of those law firms are partly controlled by private equity investors. They're not just set up as law partnerships. Some of those firms, their revenue structure, they're set up as law partnerships, but they have taken some of their in-house in-house operations and sold them to private equity firms. And those private equity firms then sell the services back to the law firms. So what that means is that some of the paperwork that was processed for these foreclosure mills was done by these outside private equity investment companies that imposed, of course, pressure to maximize returns, speed up the work volume, and take legal shortcuts. That's what happens when you impose shareholders into the mix of a law firm like that. So that's one of the reasons why, you had the sloppiness and the robo signers and the pressure to increase the volume of paperwork in order to push these foreclosures through. It didn't just come from the banks. It also came from the private equity firms that are investing in these law firms as well. Another issue related to the whole mortgage foreclosure mess, I want to talk a little bit about MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration System. Banks set up a central clearinghouse when the housing market had heated up. They set up a central clearinghouse to process the legal paperwork for transferring the ownership of mortgages. That's MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration System. It's not a public or nonprofit or government entity. It's strictly a private entity set up and owned by some of the biggest banks involved in the mortgage mess. So there's no government oversight of what MERS was doing. It turns out that MERS was very sloppy in its handling of the mortgages, of the registration and sale of mortgages. It didn't correctly oversee the transfer of titles. It didn't keep copies often of ownership documents. Documents were lost. It incorrectly and probably illegally registered itself as the owner of mortgage loans that it processed. And approximately 60% of all mortgages in the U.S. are now listed as being owned by MERS instead of by the banks or the investors that actually own the loans. Because MERS is not the legal owner of the underlying loan, it's simply an agent for the banks and investors that bought and sold mortgages and mortgage-backed securities. It means that mortgages then that are registered as being owned by MERS can be challenged by the payer, the person who owes the money on the mortgage, can then go to court and challenge that and say, well, MERS can't legally own the mortgage, and since they can't tell me who does and they're registered as the mortgagee, then I really don't owe this money to anybody. And courts are probably going to have to rule in favor of the payer in that situation, saying, well, you're right, MERS can't legally own this mortgage. They're simply an agent. It's really a bank or a number of investors that own it, but since they can't produce the paperwork proving that, the mortgage doesn't exist. That's part of the mess behind this whole foreclosure thing. In addition, MERS can't pursue foreclosure. That's what a lot of lawyers are arguing. MERS really can't pursue foreclosure since they're not the owner of the loans. And in addition, because the loans often changed hands while MERS remained listed as the owner, local governments may then turn around and sue MERS or the banks that set up MERS for the mortgage recording fees that are owed to them whenever a mortgage is bought and sold. That's another issue here that has yet to be explored. So it's literally a mess right now.
And for a change, a mess that doesn't work in favor of the banks.
Yeah, works in favor of the homeowner.
All right. Tax amnesty.
Yeah, U.S. companies are arguing that the U.S. government should give them a tax amnesty in order to bring home cash that they've made in their foreign investments. Folks might remember that in the last day or two, Google has come under fire from folks saying that, well, if you add the tax that Google pays on its foreign earnings to the tax it pays on its U.S. earnings, its overall corporate tax rate is 2.4%. Because it makes most of its money abroad and pays no tax on it, because it takes advantage of a number of tax shelters in countries like Ireland, the Netherlands, and the Caribbean.
And it's absolutely legal.
Yeah, well, Google is not alone. The Central Bank of the Netherlands estimates that I believe it is 13,000 different entities exist to shelter taxes for major corporations. that make their money abroad. And U.S. corporations are saying, well, because the U.S. market is in the doldrums and our foreign markets are making tons and tons of money for us, we want to bring some of that cash home and spend it here and create jobs, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't want to pay the 35% U.S. tax rate. Please, U.S. government, give us a tax amnesty. I think that's crazy. I think it's long past time that the U.S. government require foreign companies to bring at least a certain portion, if not all of that cash back home and pay tax on it here.
Yeah, and to put this in perspective, you know, the Google stories we're talking about, $2 billion in evaded taxes, you're looking overall at conservative estimates of some $60 billion in taxes that, you know, through this shell game have not been paid at a minimum, probably in the hundreds of billions of dollars of taxes that have not wound up in the U.S. Treasury as a result of this. And then we wonder why the federal government is running a deficit and why state and local governments are having to make such bare bone cuts.
Mm-hmm. All right. From that, on to WikiLeaks.
Yeah, real explosive revelations coming out yesterday in terms of a new batch of documents being released by WikiLeaks, probably from the same source or sources that released the documents on Afghanistan a few months ago. These are dealing with Iraq, and there's a lot more of them covering a longer period of time, really from the invasion in 2003 all the way up through last December or so. And that's one of the things that is not coming out in U.S. media coverage of this, is that this isn't all old history that happened in the, you know, early days of the Bush administration, but we're talking about civilian deaths that have not been reported before, widespread use of torture and summary executions by U.S. and U.K. forces, but also in particular by Iraqi forces that are being trained and funded by the U.S.
By Iraqi government forces and the Iraqi police.
Yeah, but bear in mind that these folks started doing this, and we were talking about this several years ago when it was in the Department of Ministry. The U.S. was literally setting up death squads with some of the same people that were used to pursue this tactic in Central America in the 1980s. Coming out of this death squad legacy, we have these reports of the U.S. official policy being not to investigate these incidents and to look the other way, so that people that the U.S. trains, people that the U.S. has funded and continues to fund, now can act with impunity under a U.S. occupation to do whatever they want to with people that in some cases the U.S. is literally handing over to them. It's very, very disturbing.
Yeah, and this comes in the same week that we see reports, a congressional report now saying that most of the members of the Sunni Awakening movement are starting to go back and join Al-Qaeda, because now that the U.S. government is turning security in Iraq over to the Iraqi government security forces, who are primarily Shiite forces, the Sunnis are finding themselves backed up against a wall.
Yeah, and we're not handing out boatloads of money anymore.
Yeah, and that's aggravating and leading to further civil war there.
Yeah.
All right. And finally, briefly, Afghanistan.
Yeah, the Afghan Electoral Commission announced this week that they have thrown out nearly a quarter of the ballots cast in the parliamentary elections in Afghanistan, and they're still not done with investigating complaints of fraud, which will take another several weeks for them to investigate all. So they've already reached the record of the presidential election last year, where a quarter of the ballots were thrown out because of fraud, and many more may still be thrown out.
All right. And events.
A couple of civic events coming up this week. On Tuesday at the City Council, the City Hall, Council Chambers, there will be a hearing on the Seattle City Council budget. We've talked about a number of the potential cuts being not real good news when you get down to the specific line items. This is your chance to show up and make yourself heard around it. Things like Scan TV and the Conflict Resolution Program and a number of other things that are on the chopping block. So that's Tuesday, the 26th, 5:30 p.m., at City Council Chambers. Then on Thursday, at the Microsoft Room in the Downtown Library on 4th Avenue, there will be a City Club conversation with new Seattle Police Chief John Diaz. So maybe you can show up and ask him why his employees have this disturbing tendency to shoot unarmed brown-skinned people. That would be at from 6 to 7:30 p.m. on Thursday evening, the 28th.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
The election print edition of Eat the State is around and is out and around at, you can, hear my Canadian accent there, can't you? At places where you find free public free periodicals around town, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, Seattle Central, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can also find us online with all those election endorsements and the blog with late breaking news, things on the WikiLeaks revelations for one and other stuff that's come out over the course of the week. That's all at www.eatthestate.org, and it also has a pretty extensive calendar listing also that you can check out of events of this upcoming week.